This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. 17 years ago, journalist and author Naomi Klein burst into international fame with her best-selling book, No Logo, taking aim at the brand bullies. Then a decade ago, Klein wrote her next book, which became even more popular, The Shock Doctrine, which was a global exploration of historical events that fit a disturbing pattern, how corporate elites use natural or man-made disasters to coerce a disoriented population with the shock therapy of even more deregulation and unfettered capitalism. Now, in 2017, Klein has taken the years of research from her earlier books to help understand how the Donald Trump presidency came about and to warn us of the shocks that are yet to come and how we can best combat them. Already a bestseller, the new book is called No Is Not Enough, Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. Naomi Klein is a syndicated columnist and author. She is also the senior correspondent for The Intercept, a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute and a contributor to The Nation magazine. She now joins me on the program. Welcome to the show, Naomi.
Thank you, Sonali. It's great to talk with you.
So your earlier books, No Logo and The Shock Doctrine, seem to prepare you perfectly for this new book, No Is Not Enough. How does Donald Trump, who you write, won the election by, quote, becoming the ultimate brand, how does he represent a perfect storm of the topics you covered in those earlier books?
Well, he does feel a little bit like a Frankenstein's monster of many of the most dangerous trends in U.S. and indeed, around the world. And one of them is this trend that I covered in my first book, No Logo, which is the way in which a lot of companies changed their corporate structure so that they were not making products and then marketing them, but saw their product as their brand, right? And primarily saw themselves as marketing-based companies that were selling an aspirational idea, an aspirational identity, and building an almost tribal relationship with their customer base. And the rise of this kind of company, which I call hollow brands, because they tend to own very little. They let other people make their products for them because they see their real work of manufacturing as being the manufacturer of image and the manufacturer of ideas. This took hold in the neoliberal period because so many of the places and institutions through which people were deriving group identity, large workforces, tightly knit communities, were fraying under neoliberal economics. And so shopping became a way to construct meaning, right? When I wrote No Logo, I was concentrating on companies like Nike, Apple, selling the idea of revolution, Starbucks selling the idea of community. These were brands that were selling quite progressive ideas, which is kind of what made it interesting to me at the time, the way they were co-opting ideas from the left, really. But Trump, as a hollow brand, as somebody who really doesn't build his own buildings anymore, who leases his name and builds this kind of branded cocoon, he has been selling an idea that is really immoral, or at least amoral, which is this idea of power through wealth, of absolute power through wealth, and being the boss who can do whatever he wants to whoever he wants because he is living this dream. And it's really a brand built around the idea of impunity, absolute freedom, which once again was a seductive idea at a time of increasing economic precariousness, the world was cleaving so sharply into big winners and big losers. And Trump's promise was, I will make you a winner.
Right. One of the things you point out in your book is that we have to, on the left, understand that he's kind of Teflon skinned, right? The scandals don't stick to him. There have been so many scandals in just the few short months he's been president, and he's just managed to walk away from most of them. The Russia investigation seems to be the one that's gotten most under his skin. Democrats are making a big deal of it. Perhaps that's why. But how does one then address that? I mean, do we come up with new and creative ways to make scandals stick and to make those violations of our Constitution count more? Or should we really be looking at it in a different way?
Well, I mean, the reason, you know, Trump made this clear on the campaign trail when he said, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, right? And even that Access Hollywood tape where he says, you know, what he can do to women and then says, and they let you do it because you're a celebrity, you know, you're rich, right? So, you know, of course he's getting away with it. That's his brand. And he has a relationship with his base that is this aspirational relationship. So they kind of like it when he gets away with it. They identify with him when he's under attack in this way. There are ways to chip away at his brand, you know, presenting him as a puppet as instead of a boss. You know, this is why these parodies get to him, like President Bannon and President Putin and all of that. You also get to him because it's obvious that he cares about his brand and his, you know, and his family fortune over everything else, right? So I think you go after him where he lives, which is his wallet. And so, you know, I think that all of these boycott campaigns are worthwhile. But ultimately, I don't think you defeat Trump politically through going after his brand. I think you defeat Trump politically by having, you know, if you will, a better product in the political space, you know, by which I mean a better offer to voters. Because where I think Trump is most vulnerable is not in his personal brand, but in this other brand, Make America Great Again, right? Because he has applied the rules of corporate branding to the construction of this political brand, right? And made these wild promises that he thinks he's going to be able to get away with. You know, he thinks he's going to be able to get away with breaking all the promises he's made to working class voters about bringing the jobs back and you know, renegotiating trade agreements in their interest, you know, protecting their health care and Social Security. I mean, he ran on this, and we're seeing him betray these promises systematically. So I think he is vulnerable on that, but my worry is that the media focus and the focus of you know, powerful Democrats is so much on this idea that he's going to be impeached and building the case for impeachment that we are neglecting telling this story that I think would be very damaging to his brand, which is really about the complete economic betrayals that his, you know, corporate cabinet is enacting every day.
I want to get to the issue of the shocks that might come and how he might capitalize on that. But I also want to just stay on this issue of how Trump got to where he is today. Hillary Clinton ran on the idea that she wasn't Trump, but still, doesn't Trump, in a way, represent a natural outcome of what both establishment Democrats and Republicans have been building for years upon years, that you know, the sort of corporate supremacy over our democracy is the path to freedom? Isn't he, in a way, just as much the Frankenstein creation of establishment Democrats like the Clintons as he is of Republicans?
Well, he absolutely is. In some ways, more so, Sonali, because, you know, it was Democrats who were most enamored of this idea of, what we call philanthrocapitalism, right? This kind of, you know, let's bring in the oligarchs who grew so wealthy in the era of privatization and deregulation, these newly minted multi-billionaires, and you know, bring them together at Davos or at the Clinton Global Initiative, and basically auction off the world's problems to these supposedly benevolent billionaires, right? So Richard Branson and Michael Bloomberg will take care of climate change, and Bill Gates will take care of, you know, the America's crumbling school system and hunger in Africa and malaria in his spare time. And what makes him qualified to solve these collective problems that we used to look to government and the United Nations to, well, simply his wealth and the fact that we extend or we bestow kind of magical powers onto anyone who can reach that strata of extreme wealth. And so, you know, those this is the mentality that very much paved the way for Trump. And not just that. I mean, I think that the whole neoliberal period, as you know, has been about this idea that anything governments can do, corporations can do better, that there's an inherent efficiency in so-called market-based solutions, in privatized solutions. You know, so we're going to solve climate change through cap and trade and creating markets in pollution, you know, a rejection of so-called top-down regulatory responses. And so all of this also set the context for Trump to make his central pitch to voters, which is, you know, vote for me, even though I have no experience in government, but because I know how to run a business, which obviously is debatable if you know anything about how Trump ran his business, but he is a rich guy, right? And his wealth is in this world, in this logic, evidence of his wisdom, success, you know, in all things. And so, you know, his pitch was vote for me because I'm rich. And because as somebody who manages a corporation, I can inherently manage a government better, right? And we see this extended and bestowed by Trump onto his children now, right? Where you have Jared Kushner, no experience. I mean, just the absurdity, I believe, as we speak, he's in the Middle East, supposedly negotiating peace, you know, in his spare time when he's not remaking American government to be more efficient and more like, you know, U.S. corporations. So this has been a deeply bipartisan process. And so the ground, the road to Trump was paved by these corporate Democrats and philanthrocapitalism, you know, as much, if not more than, you know, the conservatives who have tended to have that kind of Milton Friedman view of the only responsibility that a corporation has is to its shareholders, right? Corporations aren't supposed to save the world. It was liberals who looked to the corporate sector to save the world.
Which we call neoliberalism in part, right? So your previous book before this one, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus a Climate, that was the last time I spoke with you. Let's talk about what's at stake globally is climate change, and which is why you wrote the book. This was going to be our, you know, big ultimate existential crisis. Is that issue one of the most important that we have to deal with, that we have to think about with Trump in power as being on really shaky ground, as if it wasn't already?
Well, I mean, absolutely. Just because it so rarely makes the news doesn't make the problem go away. It's this crisis is getting worse. You know, as we speak, the flights into Arizona have been canceled, dozens of flights, because aircraft are not built, these smaller aircrafts are not built to function at the temperatures that we're seeing there right now in the midst of a historic heat wave. But every heat wave is historic, right? I mean, hottest year on record this past year, so was the year before that, and so was the year before that, right? So climate change is happening whether we talk about it or not. And in the book, I write about visiting the Great Barrier Reef last year, making a short film there, and seeing for myself this just tragedy of one of the most beautiful, vibrant places on Earth, a World Heritage Site. I mean, the Great Barrier Reef is the largest living structure in the world, and it is dying. 90% of the reef has been impacted by bleaching. When I was there, a third of the reef was already dead, and now much more of the reef has died. And this has happened because temperatures in the ocean in that area just increased 1 degree more than you know, than they had in the past, and that was enough to tip the reef into this complete crisis. So, I mean, this is one of the many ways in which the Trump presidency is, you know, comes at us at the worst possible moment, right? At the moment when we needed to leap in the face of this, of this crisis, and here we are being pushed backwards with his cabinet of climate change deniers and, you know, Secretary of State, the former CEO of Exxon. And if there is a bright spot, it is that the sheer recklessness, the sheer criminality, really, because the U.S. Went to Paris, helped negotiate that agreement, and is now in the process of trying to destroy it. That as the world sees just how far the Trump administration is willing to go in their recklessness and in their greed. People are stepping up. Other governments are stepping up, increasing their ambitions, including other governments in the United States at the state-based level, and of course under pressure from the climate justice movement at the city level. One of the most exciting, events of the Trump presidency was the way in which the mayor of Pittsburgh responded to Trump's announcement that he was pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord because he was voted in by the people of Pittsburgh, not the people of Paris. The mayor of Pittsburgh stepped up and said, well, actually, the people of Pittsburgh voted for Hillary Clinton, and I hereby commit the city to getting to 100% renewable energy by 2035, which is exactly the kind of ambition that we need to see. The good news is we don't get our energy from the federal government. We get our energy at the city level. We get our energy by decisions made at the state level. And so if more governments and institutions respond to the recklessness of the Trump administration by increasing their ambitions, by stepping up and doing more, we can minimize the damage.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Naomi Klein about her new book, No Is Not Enough, and there's a website, noisnotenough.org, where you can find out more about her upcoming events as well as the book. Naomi, I think the most important part of your book, part three, which is looking ahead and preparing for what may come, is absolutely crucial for us to discuss. It's the section is entitled How It Could Get Worse, The Shocks to Come. And this is where the work you did with your book, The Shock Doctrine, is really relevant. It feels as though no matter how many times courts strike down Trump's Muslim ban, all it might take to change the minds of those judges is one horrific terrorist attack in the United States. So let's talk about this aspect of it. It's obviously impossible to predict the future, but how do we imagine, should we try to imagine what disasters might strike so that we can prepare for them? Or is it simply about responding to them when they happen?
Well, I'm a firm believer in intellectual disaster preparedness. I don't think there's any harm in thinking through possible scenarios, not tipping into conspiracy theories, but just looking at what has happened in U.S. history in the aftermath of major shocks, whether 9/11 or Pearl Harbor, the Great Depression, how these have been historically moments when rights have been trampled on, when the most vulnerable have lost their freedom. The Japanese internment after Pearl Harbor, the internment of Japanese Americans. It's not the Japanese who did the interning, and mass deportations of Mexican Americans during the Great Depression, which is something we often don't hear about when we're celebrating New Deal era progressive advances, right? That there were fierce attacks on immigrants in that period under cover of crisis. What I found when I was writing The Shock Doctrine is that the best examples that I was able to find of societies that were able to resist attempts by governments to exploit moments of shock and trauma, whether terrorist attacks or chaotic economic crises, was a real historical memory and an ability to engage in pattern recognition, right? One example I give in the book is Argentina in 2001, when their economy spiraled into crisis and there was mass looting and rioting, and the president at the time, Fernando de la Rúa, declared a state of siege for 30 days that gave him the power to suspend the constitution. He told people to stay in their homes, and as he was speaking, the way people describe it is they could no longer hear his words declaring the state of siege because the sound of pots and pans banging from outside on the streets was so loud that it drowned him out as people all over Buenos Aires left their homes and refused to follow this dictate. If you ask them why did you do this? Why did you respond like this so powerfully and so spontaneously? What you heard again and again is, we wouldn't let them do it again. And they were referring back to a deep historical memory of how the dictatorship had started in that country in 1976, when a state of siege had been declared and national safety had been the excuse to impose military rule. So, you know, I think we need to learn from other countries, need to learn from U.S. history, need to learn from the communities that experienced this directly, including the Muslim community after 9/11. And I think there is more of a metabolizing of that history. And I think part of that response to the travel ban was an example of historical memory kicking in the United States, remembering what happened after 9/11, people saying, well, we're not going to let them do it again. But of course, the real test comes if there is, heaven forbid, a major attack in the United States, because we know Trump will take advantage of it. He's already taking advantage of attacks in other countries to say, well, this is why I should have my travel ban. But, you know, that's not the same as what he would be able to do if it happened in the United States.
Right. And what lessons can we learn from the disorientation that Americans felt after the September 11th attacks? I mean, that wasn't that long ago. Most of us remember those days. And very swiftly after the September 11th attacks, Congress passed the Patriot Act, passed the authorization for war that presidents continue to use today, although Trump seems to think he doesn't even need that. So are there lessons that we can look back and say, wait a minute, we let our government get away with these terrible impacts on our rights then, and we can't let them do it again because all that did was make us less safe and you know, expose us further?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I most remember from that period is this phrase, pre-9/11 thinking. You know, whenever people would try to put events in context that we understood, we would hear this phrase, that's pre-9/11 thinking, and this idea of sort of erasing historical memory and this idea of a kind of a year zero. We're starting again now. So I think it's important to be very aware of how that works, to be aware that Trump will be exerting huge pressure on the courts, blaming the courts. You know, he's already showed his hand on this. I think he tweeted that, you know, if anything happens, you can blame the courts, right? So we need to be aware that that may well have an impact on whether the courts will show the kind of courage that they did show when Trump first tried to impose the travel ban. It's a different story when they're being blamed for an attack. I think people need to understand that their congresspeople need to be pressured because they will also be under extraordinary amounts of pressure to toe the line. We already saw with the bombing of Syria, with Trump's bombing of Syria, the way he suddenly started to get this deferential media coverage, unlike any he had seen before. I mean, the best coverage Trump has received so far in his presidency was when he was ordering cruise missiles over chocolate cake at Mar-a-Lago. Right. So I think part of this is also holding the media accountable and insisting that people not fall for these tactics, because we lose a lot, as you say, Sonali, in these moments. And the reverberations of what was lost after 9/11 continue to this day. And I think we should take, honestly, I think we should take some inspiration from Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. And the way he had the courage after the Manchester attacks and after the London Bridge attacks to, of course, condemn these horrors and not justify them in any way, but dare to make connections between UK foreign policy, the failed war on terror paradigm, funding of, you know, Saudi Arabia weaponry. And, you know, after 9/11, if you recall, there was this really war on anybody who tried to put those events in any kind of context to say that there might have been any kind of reason. You know, and when Jeremy Corbyn did that, he got that full treatment. I mean, the Theresa May's government called his remarks monstrous. But what was interesting is that it didn't stick, right? The public, this was during the election campaign, and Jeremy Corbyn's poll numbers kept going up because it resonated with people. So we have to have the courage, right, to still know what we know today, if something happens tomorrow.
And then finally, if we aren't in the position to be political leaders ourselves, let's talk about what grassroots movements that have already been active for many years can teach us. You end your book with lessons from Standing Rock, what we can learn from the incredible Indigenous-led movement in Standing Rock, North Dakota last year. If you sort of just judge by some of the formal top-down decisions, you might imagine that that movement might have failed. However, of course, we saw recent court decisions signaling that there needs to be a do-over on the Army Corps of Engineers environmental review. So maybe it hasn't failed. How can we take what we saw at Standing Rock and apply it more broadly speaking and specifically in the Trump era?
Well, I think there are many lessons to learn from Standing Rock, including the power of taking leadership from the people who are most impacted. That immediacy, that was a movement led by the people who were most directly impacted by the pipeline, and to be honest, that's all too rare in the environmental movement, right? Which is very highly professionalized. But I think we saw some really great work of groups like 350, which I'm involved in. I'm on the board of, kind of taking a different position of more sort of putting their network at the service of the local community, and amplifying voices that were speaking from a position of such immediacy. I'm talking to particularly young people who were talking about the impact of losing their drinking water and losing their future. There's tremendous power in that. And one of the other lessons from Standing Rock is really about the true meaning of intersectionality, because it's a phrase, I guess, that gets thrown around a lot. But what is, I think what you saw and felt there was just how impossible it is to pry apart so many issues that people are struggling with, whether it's militarized police, whether it is systemic racism. I mean, that pipeline was supposed to be built through Bismarck, on a majority white city, overwhelmingly white city, and it was rejected because it was a threat to their water supply. And so just in a classic case of environmental racism, they move it to threaten the drinking water of the Standing Rock Sioux. And in addition to that, you have climate change and the fact that what's in the pipe is what's fueling climate change. You have this fusion between multinational oil companies and the state in all with all of its firepower. And so it's all interconnected. I quote Winona LaDuc in the book, speaking very eloquently about how it's all of it, right? And this is really there was a tremendous depth in the analysis there. And the other piece of it, comes back to the title that I chose for the book, No is Not Enough, is one of the things that was so embedded in the resistance in Standing Rock, is that the no to the pipeline was really just the precursor to the yes, to what people actually wanted to do, which is turn that community into a model of a justice-based transition off of fossil fuels to 100% community owned and controlled renewable energy, creating jobs and opportunities in that community, building the next economy grounded in principles of regeneration as opposed to endless extraction. And the exciting thing is that that is happening now. The move to bring renewable energy to Standing Rock is ongoing, as well as the work of the no, the court challenges, the divestment. So, all the no is still necessary, but it isn't enough.
Right. Well, Naomi Klein, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the rest of your book tour, which people can find out more about at knowisnotenough.org. Thanks so much, Naomi.
Thank you. Great to speak as always.
My guest has been Naomi Klein, the best-selling author of No Is Not Enough, Resisting the New Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. She's an award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and author of the international bestsellers This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and No Logo. She is also a senior correspondent for The Intercept, a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute, and a contributor to The Nation magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.